The Pacific Group is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all members of the community are welcome to attend. The single most important aspect of AA recovery, however, is the principle of one alcoholic relating to another alcoholic. Therefore, only alcoholics actually participate in our meetings. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful to you to contact an anonymous organization that more specifically deals with your addiction. In any case, we hope that what you've learned here may be helpful to your recovery and or your understanding. Good evening. My name is Roberta, and I am an alcoholic. Welcome to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Please note, you will be given 5-minute and 1-minute reminders when it is time to wrap up your talk. Our first 10-minute speaker is Malia Kay.
Hi, my name is Malia. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, I'd like to thank Marty for asking me to speak tonight. It's such an honor to speak at Pacific Group. This is where I got my foundation, where I got sober, and really like where I owe my life to. So thank you. I don't have much time, but I'll share in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what I try and be like today. I grew up in a family of 1 of 4 kids, and I grew up in a broken family where my dad was an active alcoholic, and I didn't understand why he left the family. I didn't understand why my mom was so upset with him all the time, and all I knew is that I got love and affection when I gave my mom comfort. She was going through a lot, and so I showed up for her emotionally as a young child. I was about 6 years old. And so I grew up hating my father and not really knowing who he was. And then at a really early age, when I started having visitations with him and started seeing him on a consistent basis, he introduced me to alcohol. And we would bond and drink all the time together. We'd go on snowboarding trips and vacations, and we would bond over drinking. And I had this relationship with a father figure that I always craved. And at the same time, there was this deep underlying, I had embodied my mother's emotions towards him. So I thought that I hated him. And at the same time, I was yearning for my father and his love and approval. And as a teenager, drinking was a lot of fun. I did it throughout high school. I dropped out of high school and I decided to do homeschooling by myself because that's more efficient and I can work full time and make money. I started dabbling in other outside issues and I got pretty involved with that. It helped me stay skinny. It helped me stay awake and do my homework the night before. It just multiplied how I wanted to feel, right? And how I wanted to feel was just not how I was feeling. It was anything outside of myself, whether I was, I just didn't want to feel how I felt. And I didn't know why I felt so uncomfortable. I didn't know what this yearning was. And after I graduated from high school, I went abroad at a semester at sea, not realizing what I was looking for was a spiritual solution to fill this God-sized hole in my heart. I didn't realize what I was looking for, and I was looking in all these countries abroad and studying all these things, and I never found what I was looking for, because even abroad I was drinking. I was not acknowledging the root of my problem. And I'm so, so grateful today, because what I do know is that there's a solution. What I do know is the root of my problem. I know that there's a spiritual malady that I have inside of me where I'm always restless, irritable, and discontent. Unless there's a sufficient solution, alcohol is my only go-to. Like, there's nothing else that will kind of take away those voices. And when those voices stopped going away, when I was drinking and using and doing whatever, then I was faced with a problem, right? Like, there's no way I could continue on like this. And there's no way that I could stop. I was too reliant upon it. It was all that I knew. I didn't have any friendly direction. And at the end of my drinking and using, I was looking at 5 years in prison, and I was doing things I was not proud of, and I couldn't look myself in the mirror and honestly tell myself that I was worthy of love and that I was capable of even being somebody. I had no idea who I was. I had lost myself in all the way. And And all I wanted to do was just numb out. I had no hope. And so I went to treatment and I got introduced to AA. And I had been in and out of the room since I was 15 years old. But now I'm 24 in treatment and I get introduced to Pacific Group. And this is a group that really just attracted me. Everybody was so bright and shiny. There was such long-term sobriety. There were people my age that I could relate to and hang out with. There were so many activities. There was yards. There was the watches. There was just so much to do. 7 meetings, 7 commitments. I was always somewhere with somebody doing something for my entire first year. And what I found is that it taught me how to show up. It taught me how to be where I say I'm going to be. It taught me how to be a good friend and how to interact with you. What I realized, though, is that activity is not recovery. And is that 1 minute? 5 minutes? Okay. Activity is not recovery. When I had about 6 months sober, I had come across some alcohol or something in my car and I ingested it. And I didn't tell anybody about it because I was right in the middle of Pacific Group. I was active in the meetings. I had all the commitments. I had all the friends going to all the things. And I had this slip that I was too ashamed to talk about. And so I kept it inside. It was something I was never going to share. And I had 6 months sober at that point in time. So when it finally came time for my year, I didn't tell anybody I had that slip. And so I took cakes. I had a yard party. I had a watch. I took cakes at every single meeting. And I lied to all of you because I was too ashamed to admit that, one, I had lied. Two, I had relapsed. And three, I was not willing to look bad. How I thought that you thought of me meant more to me than being honest and having a chance of staying sober. And it wasn't until I started working with somebody else who really took me through the steps. Because I told you my first year of sobriety was very activity oriented, but it wasn't until I started working the steps did I start to change. And did I start to feel different? And did I start to show up differently? When I started to go through the steps, I got to see in my inventory process how I show up, how I recreate my fears, because my fears are always the same thing. It's always I'm going to be alone. It's always I'm not good enough. It's always you don't like me. So with all my fears being the same and being driven by 100 different forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, I step on the toes of all my fellows. I step on the toes of my family, my relationships, everybody in my life. And so when I was living in a tent on the side of the freeway before I got sober, like that's where I belong because that's the kind of person I was. I was not an honest person and I was a coward. But I wasn't willing to let any of you think that. So when it came time to get honest about my sobriety date, you know, the lady who I was working with at that time, we came up with a date. It was as far as out as I could really know because all I knew was a Wednesday night sometime in October, November. So my new sobriety date is November 15th of 2018. So next month I'll have 2 years. And having to go back to everybody who came to my yard party, who came to the watch, who supported me through this journey, and get honest, right? And make amends to the secretaries for taking dirty cakes, paying back all the money that was paid to me in the cards and the gifts. That was the most freeing experience and the most humbling and the most embarrassing and shameful. But once I worked through all of that, it was like I knew that there was a chance because that was the one thing I was going to take with me. So now, as I'm going through steps, I get to work a 4-step anytime I'm going through something, right? Because life in sobriety is not always that great. I still have feelings. There's things that happen. But I have a solution today. And my solution is the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. My solution is a contact with something bigger than myself, right? I have a sponsor today. I have such a great support group. I have all of you, which I can rely upon. Anybody I can call in this room, I know you'd be there because I know I'd show up for you too. It's such an honor to be called upon and be able to show up for you. And so I mean, all the blessings that I have now in my life are because of being sober, right? I got to make amends to my father. Is that 1 minute? I got to make amends to my father, who I hadn't spoken to in almost 10 years. And I got to sit down with him, and I got to tell him that I wasn't a good daughter to him, right? But I wanted to have a relationship with him. And he got to see me sober. And then he told me about his experience in AA, and we got to bond over that. And I got to see him as a human being. I didn't have all this hatred, because that all came out in my inventory. That all came out in this 12 steps. And so I got to sit down with him person to person, face to face, and just have a conversation heart to heart. And so everything that I have today is because I'm a different person. I'm not the same girl I was 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago. I'm so, so blessed today. And it's all because of you. And so with that, thank you so much for my sobriety in my life.
You were muted, Roberta.
That was unfortunate. I'm so sorry. Okay, thank you. Our second 10-minute speaker is Sean C.
Good evening. My name is Sean Craighead. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Marty for asking me to come out and speak. And Malia, that was great. My sobriety date is July the 10th, 2010. You guys in my home group, Thomas Sells is my sponsor, and those things have been constant for a long period of time. My connection is a little sketchy. So what I normally do is I'll go over to the non-video participants window and just look at a black screen. I like to call it the half measures area of the meeting, and I like to hang out over there, just look at nobody, but I'm kind of forced to stare at me while you guys are staring at me, so here goes nothing. I also want to thank Eddie S. for giving me a call to call Marty. I thought I was in a little bit of trouble. Eddie S. calls me and goes, "Hey, how's it going?" He starts some small talk. I'm like, "Hey, how's it going?" He goes, "Marty wants to talk to you." And he goes, "You know the drill." And I thought it was code word for "you're in trouble." And so I got off the phone, and I'm calling Marty, and I'm on the phone, and I'm giving him the sir thing. I'm like, "Hello, sir." And he goes, "Hey, can you do 10 minutes for me?" And all of a sudden, my heart just dropped. I was just so happy that that's all he wanted. At any rate, so I was born in South Central Los Angeles, Adams and Crenshaw. I grew up with my mom, my great-grandmother, and her best friend. Basically, a lot of old ladies. And when you're a little kid, a lot of old ladies, you get a lot of treats. And so I was spoiled as a kid. And that was good for me because I was kind of a quiet kid. Being an only child, you just kind of play to yourself a lot. And that was good for me. It was good, but it was also bad. It was time to go to school. I didn't interact with kids very well. I just didn't. And as a result, I was uncomfortable. But for me, when I was uncomfortable, I would get angry. And because I didn't like the feeling of being uncomfortable. So I also had really bad sinuses. So at night, I wouldn't sleep very well. So my mom give me what was called back in the 70s a hot toddy, which was made from Kessler's whiskey, a lot of garlic and honey and lemon, and it was cooked slowly for a long period of time, and they poured it in this big old vast and they would give me this little bitty shot of it. And it was sweet, it was warm. And all I knew was is that all of a sudden I could breathe easy. I could smell the flowers from across the street. It just made me feel good. And as a little kid, that's the way I associated alcohol. It's something that makes you feel good. The first time I had a beer, fast forward, I'm in ninth grade. I'm at a ditch day party, and guy Fernando walks up and hands me a Budweiser, and I didn't want the beer, but there was a girl there that was drinking, and I wanted to impress her, so knocked back the beer. It tasted horrible. It tasted like earwax. It was disgusting. I didn't understand why people like this stuff. At any rate, I continued to keep drinking, and I just fought through the smell, fought through the taste, and after a while, it was just good. And I never stopped drinking. Once I left high school, moved to Orange County, which is where I'm at now, and that's when my drinking took off. So I collected a few DUIs, wouldn't let me drive anymore. And what wound up happening was got a note from the judge and wound up in AA in 1996. I just went from meeting to meeting, sponsor to sponsor, never getting sober. After about 10 years of doing this, I didn't think AA really worked for me. But I kept trying. I just kept coming back. I don't know why I did, I just did. I didn't know what else to do. And I think the turning was I was able to finally get 6 months, 2008, and I was going nuts, and I wound stumbling into an AA meeting, and I ran into my sponsor that was going to sponsor me. I didn't know at the time for the next 8 years, brought me to the Pacific Group. If you've gone to regular AA meetings and then you come to the Pacific Group, it's like the difference between going to like the Santa Ana Zoo and the San Diego Zoo. All of a sudden, you go from a few people that may not make a whole lot of sense to a whole lot of people that don't make a lot of sense. And but oddly enough, I wanted to stay. Although I didn't stay then, I came back a few years later and stumbling in again. This time, I had a little time under my belt, and where I met my sponsor. My new sponsor was Thomas, and Thomas was a lot different than anybody else I dealt with, because he would just give me orders and I would just do them, and I would come back and he would have more stuff for me to do, and this has been one of the hardest years for me, and I'm going to kind of cut this short. I really had to lean on Alcoholics Anonymous and the Pacific Group to get through some rough goes, some rough times. And if you're new, you have to understand one thing. So sometimes sobriety just got to be enough. I like a lot of different things, but the one thing that keeps me grounded is you guys. I'm a little bit at a loss for words, but what I could tell you after 10 years of being sober, what I've learned is that the 10 years that I was drinking and still coming to AA meetings taught me that no matter what, if I keep coming back, something will change. If you're looking for change, you have to kind of be the change. And it starts here with these guys. There's some really great people in this room. I'm looking at them right now that really inspire me. I don't want to be remiss if I don't mention people like Roberta and like Bola. I love you guys. I really do. If you're new and you don't know anybody here, everybody here will get to know you. All you have to do is just keep coming back and back and back. I'm a testament to what happens if you just don't quit. Sometimes you want to quit, and I've wanted to quit. I mean, a lot. Anybody that knows me, I've never stuck. But bottom line is right now, I'm a happily married man. I have three beautiful kids. I have a great career. I have the best sponsor in the world. He'd go to bat for me no matter what. And half of you would too. And I'll tell you what, it made me want to pick up a bat and go for you too. I'll go to bat for you. That's all my time. Thank you so much. God bless y'all. Good night.
Need to unmute.
Our main speaker tonight is Charlie H.
My name's Charlie Hill, and I'm an alcoholic. And I picked one nice little small screen, and as far as I'm concerned, that's all I'm talking to. I am very, very honored to be here. I'm writing down the time. I got 35 minutes, so that's about 11 minutes each of what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. So I got to get moving, you know. I guess the first thing I should do is give you my stats now that I've said thank you. And I'm going to say thank you again to the Pacific Group later in my talk, because the Pacific Group, specifically five members of the Pacific Group, are the reason I'm sober. And most of you people don't know me from Adam. I don't live down there. But the speakers from the Pacific Group were my link to Alcoholics Anonymous, my foundation in AA. So here we go. Charlie Hill, alcoholic. That part's true. I don't know about the rest of this. I got to say thank you, Malie and Sean. Sean, you and I have a lot in common. I was born in Compton, actually. So, you know, on Las Campanas Hospital. So a long time ago. And Malia, thanks for your talk. Thanks for your talk. You said something I really liked. What did you say? Skinny and awake. Yeah, that was one of my goals while I was out there. I was a dice dealer. I always wanted to be skinny and awake. You know, had a lot to do with my income. But that's it. I got a home group. My home group is Searchlight Nevada, which I really want to say a couple things about Searchlight Nevada. We have five home group members. Searchlight Nevada is a town of 500 people. It's about 45 miles south of Las Vegas. It's on the road from Las Vegas to Bullhead City. It's a gateway to Bullhead City. And it's trailers is what it is. There's only a couple of stick-built houses in there, and they say there's 800 people there, but it's really 500. There's 300 of them are Californians that use it as an address so they can avoid your taxes. And they just store all their toys there. But there's 500 people there. And we have a small group. And it started 36 years ago, but one guy, he moved there. His sponsor told him that he said he didn't have a meeting in town, so his sponsor said, you do now. And so they started the meeting at 8 o'clock on Wednesdays at the fire hall, and that meeting still goes on today. It's never been dark. In fact, there's a live meeting there on Wednesday night. There's one there right now, probably 15 to 30 people. The interesting thing is the length of sobriety of the people that go there. There's some people here on the screen that have been there. I think it's because, you know, mostly long-term people go there, and they go there to support that little group out there in the middle of the desert. And plus, it's, you know, 100 miles round trip is a long way to go to get a court paper signed. But it's over the years, these people stop by there. They get a little nostalgia there, and the length of time is ridiculous. I got a sobriety date of November 19th, 1979. So, you know, I got 40 years. That's a reasonable amount of time. And not that long ago, we had a birthday. I think Rennie might have tuned in on that one. We had a birthday. The guy had 45 years. That's a good chunk of time. So we called on Gary, and Gary is one of our home group members. He was 12-step by Sylvia Kay, you know, and Keys of Kingdom. And say he's got 55 years. And he called on this guy named Tom Kay, and his grand sponsor was Earl Treat, whose story's in the big book. And he's got 65 years. So what's really funny is when somebody goes to that town and they're down lit fishing at the lake or something, they think, you know, I think I'll go up there and kind of support that little meeting. And the average length of time is ridiculous there. We're going to change the format. It's going to say, those of you with less than 30 years and newcomers, if you'd like to introduce yourself, please do so. Not to embarrass you, you know, just to get to know you. So, but that's my home group. I love my home group. I have a sponsor. My sponsor is Marty. And he didn't ask me to do this. I just recently asked him to sponsor me. So he asked me to do this before he became my sponsor. And I just hope my talk tonight does not discourage his enthusiasm on that. My sponsor before that was Clancy for many, many years. And then it seemed like before that, everybody that sponsored me has Clancy as a grand sponsor. Dave Hamza, some of you old timers might remember him. He's a pretty good character. He's made an impact on a specific group a couple times. And in fact, I think Clancy had him in a headlock once, if I recall. That was my sponsor for a long time. That was a great sponsor. You know, if you get a heavyweight boxer as a sponsor and you're talking in a meeting and somebody says, you're doing it wrong, I would just write Dave's number down and give it to him. Say, call this guy. And nobody ever called him. And after that, my sponsor was a guy named Gail, whose sponsor was Joe Clements. Some of you might know him. Joe Clements was sponsored by Clancy. And so I've always had this link with the Pacific Group. There's a lot of smoke in the air up here. I'm really glad that we're on Zoom. I'm glad we're on Zoom because you can drink during a meeting. Don't take that as an invitation. I'll play our national anthem. How's that? Oh, that helped. Something about our old timers. I got to say one other thing about our old timers. I love the old timers in our meeting, but when they talk, they just keep getting closer and closer to the camera. And eventually this is what you see, you know, and is that true everywhere or just in Searchlight? I don't know. Anyway, I gotta get going. I burn up 6 minutes of my drunk log there. Okay, so I was born in Compton, California, and my dad was a happy-go-lucky guy. He was a World War II guy, blue-collar worker, truck driver, charming guy when he was charming, and when he wasn't, he really wasn't. So he was a Jekyll and Hyde kind of drunk. We went from Compton to Chino. He figured we were better off in Chino, and then in 1954, he moved us to the desert outside of Las Vegas. I'm sure some of you here are familiar with Las Vegas. When I say desert outside of Las Vegas, we were on the corner of Sahara and Decatur, and it was desert, and it was gravel, and we had a homestead. And the homestead, the way the homesteads worked is if you, in the 50s, if you were willing to live in Las Vegas, and you would build a small house, maybe 15 by 30, and you'd live there for 5 years, they gave you the 5 acres around it. So my dad made this deal, and we had a house right there in the corner. And there was nothing in the ground between us and the Flamingo Hotel. There was not a stick in the ground. There's no houses there. And if you can imagine back then, I mean, at that period of time, there was no air conditioning. We had no electricity, in fact. This house, we were poor. This house had no interior walls. We had blankets up so we could have some privacy. We had no heat or air. And we had we went and got ice so we could keep our food cold. We hauled water in 50-gallon drums so that we could take baths, and we had a toilet in the back. You know, we dug a hole and built a little shed there. So we had an outhouse. And personally, I thought it was great. I love this place because I was, I was 6 years old. And so we could chase rattlesnakes and turtles and lizards, and we were out in the desert. For a kid, it was a great thing. And I never felt bad about it until I went to school. Then I went to school, and then I realized that I was poor. I didn't know until then. And then people would, you know, had bathrooms and interior walls, and they would say things like, do you want to do a sleepover? So I knew I was living in a different household, because I'd never have a sleepover at my house, because my dad either, he was smacking my mom around or scaring us kids, and didn't bring the check home, and I never wanted to be anything like him because he was a drunk. At some point, we moved to North Las Vegas. We moved to a really tough area, and I was not tough. I was quick. I was the second fastest guy in my school, so I made friends with the guy that was the first fastest, and I just avoided all fights. I was just scared. I was a nervous kid. I was scared. I can still remember trying to get out of school 5 minutes early, because if you did, you had a clear path home, and I could get home without getting thumped. And that's something I don't want to admit. I'd rather say I was a tough guy, but I wasn't. I was afraid. If you look tough and you gave me that tough look, I just believed you. I bought it. I figured you were tough all the way through, and I didn't realize. Since then, I've sponsored some bullies, and they might be, you know, dangerous, but they're not tough. But I was afraid of them all. I was afraid of the girls too. The girls were scary too. But in junior high school, I went to a dance, and this is what makes me an alcoholic. And it's I go to this dance, and they had this. These guys said, "Let's go out in the park lot. We're going to do something." And we go out there, and you start passing around a bottle of 10 High whiskey. And when they passed it around, I didn't want to drink it. Because my dad drank it, and I didn't like him. But I did it to fit in. And the third drink was the magic of alcohol for this guy. First couple of drinks didn't do anything. Man, that third drink got me. I took the third drink. It hit my stomach. It went out to my fingertips. And the weight just fell off my shoulders. And man, I exhaled. It's like I've been holding my breath all up until that moment. And then we finished the bottle. We kept drinking. And after a few more drinks, I'm looking at these guys and I'm thinking, you know what? These guys are lucky I'm here. And I just thought, man, I just fit in. It was like a bridge between how I felt and the rest of the human race. And I really felt like I fit in. And I go back into this dance, and there was this one guy. There was this one rather large fellow, and he terrorized me all through school. And he's looking at me. It's a tough guy looking. I'm looking at him, and just for no reason, I looked at him. I said, "What are you looking at?" And he didn't know how to respond. You know, he wasn't used to that kind of talk from me. And he said, "What?" I said, "You heard me. What are you looking at?" And he thought about it for a minute. He says, "Nothing." You know, he didn't know what to say. He just wasn't ready for the remark. So I said, "That's right." You know, I just went into the dance. I was not delusional. I did not think I could beat that guy up, but I was not afraid of him. Oh my God, what a great feeling. I was not afraid of him. He could have beat me to death. It didn't matter, man, from that moment. I was not afraid of him. And that is just a tremendous, tremendous feeling. And I don't think normal people get that. And so I just drank as much as I could. In fact, I went into the dance. I asked a girl to dance. She said no. Usually that would finish me for the evening. I just went and asked another girl, and she said yes. And I got pretty good at that girl thing. I spent 6 years in high school because of being so good with that girl thing. I got a girl pregnant. And back then we didn't have baby mamas. And so we got married. And then a year later we get divorced. I go back to high school as a divorcee, and I finished up high school. So you're looking at a guy who got married and divorced before he got out of high school. I paid child support for 31 years. You know, I was just not the problem was I interview well. You know, if I meet a girl and I want what she's got, then she might as well just give it up, because I'm just going to be wonderful until she does. And then when she takes me home, she realizes she's married the wrong guy, because I'm not the guy that I interviewed with, you know. And so consequently, I have 4 divorces behind me. I got a bunch of kids that other people have to raise, and that's my story. And so I had to get sober. So got out of high school, got in trouble. I did graduate, got in trouble, went in the Army, came back, became a dice dealer, and then it really took off. As a dice dealer, you could drink. As long as you could deal a game, you could drink. So I drank like a fish. I started doing weird things. I called in sick on my day off once, and just weird stuff. And they finally... I knew I had to get sober, because I was just out of my mind. I was peeking through the hole in the door, you know, to see who was out there, and just paranoid and crazy, and I needed to get sober. But the biggest thing was I couldn't see my kids, and I wanted to see my kids for Christmas. I talked my ex-wives into letting them come see me for Christmas of 1978. So I went and joined AA on the 11th of December, and I convinced them I was going to be sober on Christmas Eve, and I did not drink until Christmas Eve. And on Christmas Eve, I took a shot of Scotch whiskey just to take the edge off. And I don't know what I really don't know what I did. I don't remember Christmas Day, but I did whatever I did. I didn't get to see my kids, 2 of them, for 8 years. I I really messed up. And I went on a runner, ended in May, came into AA, stayed sober till November 79. Birthday in November 79, I took a drink to celebrate. Celebrated my 6 months of sobriety. And had a car wreck, chased with a couple of felonies. I lost everything I owned in 12 hours, and I'm really grateful for that. And then I haven't had a drink since. And getting sober in Las Vegas is great. Getting sober, there's a place to get sober. I mean, they're serious about it. You know, you can drink. You know what I never heard while I was drinking? Last call. I never heard that term until I got sober and moved to Idaho. Somebody was talking about last call. I said, what are you guys talking about? But we don't have last call in Las Vegas. We don't. There's no such animal. So, I mean, it got me here quicker. But I haven't had a drink since November 19th of 79. I got a sponsor named Dick Toussaint. And I already had 3 sobriety dates. So if you're new here tonight, here's how I came in. I came in, I didn't like old timers, for starters. I liked new guys. I liked new people. I'd hang out with the new people. We'd sit in coffee shops and drink coffee until we jittered. And we'd say things like, let us love you till you love yourself. And the door swings both ways. And I just loved that whole environment. And we would make fun of the old timers. Listen to this guy, you know. And then I kept drinking. And my sponsor, Dick Toussaint, said, listen, I like this meeting where all these showgirls would meet in the shallow end of the pool at the Triangle Club and on Saturday mornings. That was my favorite meeting. And he said, you need to go to this other meeting downtown. And it was at the TIE Club. Some of you know where that is. And at the down and dirty AA Club. I go down there. It looks like the bar scene in Star Wars. It's smoky and the scary guys in there, you know, giving you that, do you want what we have? You know, and I was scared of them, and I didn't like what they had to say. And after the meeting, Dick asked me, how'd you like that? I said, I did not like what they had to say, because they didn't make any sense. I told them my problems, and they asked me if I had a book. And he said, well, you can relax. He says, you're never going to sound like that, because you're never going to be an old-timer with an attitude like that. So just relax. And so I started trying to learn to like what old-timers said. I made it my task. I wanted to like what they said, because they were old timers and I knew I was doomed. I knew that I was going to die out there. I was going to get, somebody was going to stab me, because my hobby when I was drinking was other people's women. And I was going to get killed. And so I'll be darned if I began to hang out with these old timers. I heard some really great things. And one of the things I heard was this, I had about 12 days sober, and there was this one guy called Sanford. And he's talking, and he says, I want to be, though my goal is to be transparent in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I pigeonholed him after the meeting. And I said, what do you mean by that? And he says, well, whatever impression you have of me is the right impression. And that's what I'd like to tell you tonight. Whatever impression you have of me is the right impression. If you like me, it's because you like me, not something I'm trying to be. So you'll like me. And he said that whatever you think of me, I don't want to change it. This is it. And I said, well, that's a good idea. I'm going to do that. And I started to get up, and he said, well, wait a second. He says, I don't think transparency is a good look on you. I said, what do you mean? He says, well, you know, because you're a jerk. He says, you need to develop some qualities that look good, you know, if you're going to be transparent. And I said, wow, this is going to take some work. Because I just didn't have a lot of virtues. So I got a chance early on to, well, first of all, doing the steps, I did them out of peer pressure, because the people I was hanging out with, Bob D and all these guys, they were all steps ahead of me. And I wanted to, when I was sitting in the Denny's, I wanted to be able to say, yeah, I'm a step 5. And so I started doing the steps out of peer pressure, and I did them. And I don't think there's a wrong way to do the steps. I think the wrong way would be not to do them. But other than that, I've seen a lot of different ways to do the steps. And I also don't think there's a particular way, none other, to do the steps. You know? In fact, I went to a meeting like that. I went to a meeting, and they said that we don't want you to share unless you've done the steps the way we did the steps, and otherwise shut up. And I thought, well, I've done the steps. And then afterwards they said, well, unless you do the steps with one of us, you haven't done the steps, so we'll talk. And I thought, I said, well, wait a minute. I'm in a meeting where Bill and Bob couldn't share, because neither one of them did the steps the way you guys just told me you did the steps, you know, since they didn't exist. So anyway, Bill and Bob came to Searchlight, they could share. So where was I? Oh, so I got a chance. I was having trouble staying sober in Vegas. I had 3 sobriety dates in quick succession. None of my kids are talking to me. I'm not allowed in my family's house anymore. And I got a chance to go to Idaho and get in the mining business. And I went to Dick Tucson. I said, listen, I got this chance. I'm going to Idaho. And he didn't even ask me about the business. He said, do you know anybody in Idaho? And I said, no, I do not. He said, you should go to Idaho. And because everybody I knew in Las Vegas, I was drinking and doing crazy stuff with. So he says, let's find you a connection first. He says, let's get you a contact in Idaho first. And the place I went to was Cary, Idaho, a little tiny town. And I called up Twin Falls, and they said there's a guy there, and he's in AA, so he'd be your contact. And this town of Cary had 125 people live there. So, and I managed to be right next door to the guy that was supposed to be my contact. And I pulled up there. In fact, I was a pit boss in Las Vegas when I decided to go into mining business. So I sold all my suits, and I get my white-on-white Lincoln, and I cruise on up to Idaho to be an underground miner. And I go next door to this old house where this guy was at, and I knocked on the door, and he didn't want to let me in. He finally let me in, and he's carrying a gun. And turns out he had gotten in trouble with a mob girl in Vegas. And he thought there was a hit out on him. And I showed up in a white-on-white Lincoln from Las Vegas knocking on the door. And he literally thought I was there to whack him. So that was my one contact in Idaho. I said, well, this ain't going to work. So 44 miles away in a town of Ketchum, there was a meeting. And I go to that meeting. And I go there, and there's one. It was hard to find a meeting. And I've got 6 months sober, so I'm kind of hanging on by a thread. And I finally found this meeting, and there was one table there. And there was a guy with a coffee pot, and he was listening to a tape. In fact, he was listening to Clancy. And I came in, and he said, are you looking for the AA meeting? And I said, yes. He said, well, come on in. And he shut the tape off, and I sat down, and he started talking. We each had 30 minutes. That was kind of, you know, there's only 2 of us. But he told me his story, and it was a great story. And then he says, well, tell me your story. And I was telling him my story. And inadvertently, I mentioned that I had smoked pot in high school. And I got to tell you, I'll never be a spokesperson for pot. I didn't like it. It made me stupid, hungry, and paranoid. That's all it did for me. The only reason I did was if I was interviewing with a girl, you know. And so I just mentioned it. That's all I did. And he goes, just like this. He goes, hold it right there, buddy. We don't talk about that in here. And I'm looking around. It's just him and I. I mean, we're the only guys in the room. And what do you want me to do? Anyway, he didn't like me. For one thing, I'm way too happy for some people. I'm like the golden lab of AA. I'm, you know, I'm really glad you're here and welcome home. And it takes some getting used to. But he didn't like me. I know he didn't like me because he started another meeting. He started a meeting in Sun Valley. He didn't tell me about it. But what he did was he gave me these 5 cassette tapes, and because everything in Idaho was a long way from anywhere, and he gave me 5 cassettes. It was Norm Alpe, Sybil Corwin, Chuck C, Clancy, and Johnny Harris. And those cassettes are what I listen to. Every time I get in my car and go somewhere, I would listen to those cassettes over and over and over. And I'm in this mining camp. There's no AA. I would read a story out of the big book at night. And I would read the grapevine every month, one article at a time. So I didn't read the whole thing at once. And I would listen to those 5 cassettes over and over. And they were the foundation for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. The message that they gave me was what it took to be a card-carrying member of Alcoholics Anonymous if you wanted this thing long-term. And I bought it. And I don't think I would have made it if it hadn't been for those. So whenever I get asked to do something like this, especially to come to this group, because I owe you guys my life. You know, all those people were members of this group and one way or another. And I owe you guys my life because that's what kept me going, that beginning of my sobriety. And so when I get asked to speak, I take it pretty seriously. I would never want to get up here and embarrass whoever asked me to come or to give somebody a false impression of what Alcoholics Anonymous is or isn't, or to ridicule AA by cursing or, you know, being an exhibitionist about certain things. I don't want to do that. I have a great respect for whoever might hear this. And if there's somebody out there listening to this in a mining camp, give me a call. So I stayed sober and I got rich. up there, which is not a good thing for me. A guy from Compton, I went a little crazy with the money. First thing I did was buy an airplane, and I would fly it to meetings and let you know that I flew to meetings. And I'm Charlie Hill, I'm an alcoholic, and I flew here in my own airplane. I had 3 years sober. So I was not a welcome guest in some meetings in Gooding, Idaho, but I stayed sober, and I lost all the money. We lost all the money just before I was 3 years sober. So I went from being a paper millionaire to broke. And so I asked another girl to marry me just to make myself feel better. And I left town. And I left there and I went to Jackpot, Nevada. I made enough money to get to Reno. Lived in a borrowed car, not even my car. 1962 Mercury, which is an excellent vehicle if you're thinking of moving into a vehicle. That thing is huge. Oh, it's a great car. But I went back to being a dice dealer, got my wife down there, went to AA immediately. Everywhere I went to Alcoholics Anonymous first. I always found a meeting first because I knew that that was the most important thing for me, stay sober. So I'm in Reno, and some of you have heard a story, but since this is a Zoom meeting and I don't know who's listening, I can't really tell the story. But I'll let you know that I was cheating on my wife, and it wasn't a good picture, I was getting ready to drink, and a guy named Dave Hamza got a hold of me, and he made me tell all those women the truth, and I did in one day, and all those women left except one, and that girl is the love of my life. She's still with me today. We've been together 36 years. So you're looking at a guy that got married and divorced before he got out of high school, and I've been with the same woman now for 36 years, and I'm not that guy. There's no way the guy who came in here could have become this guy. It's impossible. It happened as a result of all this, of all of you, of doing the steps and taking people through the steps. Probably the biggest thing, I think, is taking other people through the steps. Because I was the guy that I wanted to polish myself. I wanted to you can't give away what you don't have. So I wanted to do the steps and get really good at them so I could really take guys through the steps. And Dave Hamza told me, don't do that. You know, just if you get somebody sick enough to want what you have, you just got to take them through the steps. And I started doing that. He told me that I needed to sponsor people, and he gave me a pitch. And what he told me was after the meeting, when the new guys, get them before they slide out the door, because they do slide out the door quick. And he said, go up and call them by name. Call them by name. What I would do is I would go up and say, hi, I'm Charlie. And it means nothing because you know how it is. You meet 10 people in the greeting line, you don't remember anybody's name. But so I would go up and I would get their name. Like I got Terrence, and I'm glad you're here, Terrence. I hope to see you at another meeting. That was how the pitch went. Max, I'm glad you're here, and I hope to see you at another meeting. Glad you're here, Justin. I hope to see you at another meeting. And that was my whole pitch. And what would happen is the following week, those guys would look for the guy that remembered their name. And then they would come up and talk. And then I would introduce them around, and maybe they'd ask one of them to sponsor. But sometimes I'd get the nod. And next thing you know, I'm sponsoring guys. And these guys don't know anything about my story. They just know that I'm the guy that remembered their name and walked up and said hi. And that's all. That's what it takes. And so I began to do that. And I'm glad that that happened to me this way, because my life sober has been, to me, just astonishing. We moved from Reno. We went broke in Reno, Irene and I. And then we moved to Auburn, California. We were really broke. We didn't have a dollar to put in a basket for 2 years. But we go to Auburn, and they're not doing it right. I don't know about anybody else, but every time you move, it seems like they're just not doing it right. So we go there, and they're not doing it right. And Dave Hamza is my sponsor, and he says, here's what you need to do. He says, you need to build a fellowship. You have to get a fellowship to go up around you, because the fellowship that you're going to go to that meeting, and there's a fellowship there, but that's not the fellowship you crave. And he said, the fellowship you crave isn't even in the room yet, which didn't make any sense. He says, they're still drinking, or they haven't moved there yet. That's where your fellowship is. He says, you need a fellowship that grows up around you. And so what I began, he says, I want you to make sure you talk to those newcomers. And then the other demographic we miss, I think, a lot is visitors. Because when they wrote the book, they said, frequent contact with each other, newcomers, is the right part of our lives. And there weren't any visitors. There weren't any people relocating. But now there's a lot of people. you know, if you get sober in someplace like Cleveland, which has got probably good AA, but I don't know about their weather. So after they're done making their living, they might come out someplace like San Diego or California, want to move, or Vegas. And they show up, and the first thing that happens, they don't like the meetings because they don't, we're not doing it like they do it back home. So what happens? They call their sponsor back home, and they talk to their friends back home, and they drift away from meetings. They don't get the contact. And next thing you know, they're coming in picking up a chip. Maybe. Because in Vegas, we get a lot of people picking up chips that blew off 10, 20, 30 years sober. And it's the same story each time. You know, they came in, they didn't like the meetings, they drifted away. So what I feel my job is, when somebody comes to a meeting, as long as I can just remember where they're from, somebody comes to a meeting, they're from Reseda, like Kenny, I would say, hey, Reseda, what's happening? You know, what brings you to Las Vegas? Why are you here? What are you doing here? And then if they didn't, and then tell them, hey, look, there's another meeting. We've got a meeting at Searchlight, and get them in the deal. And so I would say I'm fortunate enough to sponsor a lot of guys. And I think almost all of them gotten just that way, newcomers or visitors that came and relocated into the area. And taking guys through the steps is what did it for me. Malia talked about that a little bit, that me doing the steps for me isn't the answer. Now, what I need to do is I need to take other guys through the steps. And I've had a great time in Alcoholics Anonymous. I really had a great time. This is, I insist on having a great time. I got to build myself in Alcoholics Anonymous. I looked around the rooms and I would see guys with a lot of time and they were just happy. You could see them. You could tell when you look in their eye and it just matches their skin. You know what I mean? And you could just tell that they're comfortable in there. And then there's other guys that, you know, they're just like, you've been like this for 20 years, you know? And so I would watch what the happy guys were doing and I would do that. And then I would like the other guys and I would avoid what they were doing. And I got to build myself because there's nothing I would want to be restored to from before I got here. There's no time in my life that I would want to be restored to. It doesn't exist. I got to rebuild myself in here with people like you. I stole everything I got. Everything good and wonderful in my life, I stole it from you. What a great deal this is. So here's the deal. We're in Auburn, California, and we're broke. We were cleaning the AA hall on weekends to do Seventh Tradition because we had $6 a day to live on. That was it. And we had Irene and I as St. Bernard and a kid. So you can't, if you go to two meetings and put a buck in, now you got $4 a day to live on. You cannot do it. So we literally cleaned the help hall, the AA hall. That was our Seventh Tradition. At the end of 2 years, things looked like they weren't getting any better. I was in a big jam. I won't go into it. But the guys I'm sponsoring, man, they're just knocking it out of the park. You know, they're getting jobs, they're getting money, and they're going on vacation. And Irene and I wanted to go on vacation, but we didn't have any money. So Irene said one night, she says, you know, we have terrible jobs here. She says, why don't we just move someplace beautiful and get a terrible job there? And I was like, boom, what a great idea. So we decided to do, we made a conscious decision to move to beautiful places, get terrible jobs, and live there for like three and a half years, sponsor people, start meetings, get a pocket of enthusiasm going, get a fellowship to go up around us. And then about three and a half years, we'd pick another beautiful place and move there. So that was our vacation. We started doing that in 1993. So here's what we did. We moved from Auburn, California to Sedona, Arizona. Not a bad spot. And we got there and boy, they weren't doing the meetings right. They were terrible. So we fixed them. And then we were on vacation in Cabo San Lucas, Mexico. And we're looking around and I said, what do you think? She says, I'm in, you know. And so we had a garage sale and we moved to Cabo San Lucas, Mexico and lived there. Had a great meeting in the Hacienda Hotel. What a great spot. And from there, we went to Sisters Bend, Oregon, you know, with the snow-capped mountains from horizon to horizon. We lived there for about 4 years. One cold winter day, we were going up the Highway 1 in Boca Raton, Florida, and there was a sign that said, apartment for rent. It was $800 on the beach. So we moved. And then we lived there for about 4 years, and we moved to North Palm Beach, Jupiter, because it's cool to say you're from Jupiter. Then we went back to Cabo San Lucas, and I got lucky. We made so much money that I've never done an honest day's work since. We moved to Todos Santos, Mexico, where there were 6 meetings a week and only 5 of us in AA. So every night we would go and look at each other. We could have told each other stories. Then we lived there, and then my sister and my stepdad died in 07, 14 days apart, just before Christmas. And my little mom, 82 years old, deaf, with a blind watchdog. And we sold everything we had in Cabo and Todos Santos, moved to Vegas, and we've been taking care of my mom since 07. And then we took Searchlight as our home group because I have a big connection there in Searchlight. So that's been it. You know, we've been here taking care of my mom and doing AA ever since. And we've just had a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful life. I want to tell you something that I love you. There's nothing you can do about that. I love you. And it doesn't mean I like all of you, because if you do, you're not going to enough meetings. But I love each and every one of you. And I can prove it. I'll tell you a quick story. I puked in my pants once. So, no, I was sitting on the toilet when it happened. But if I said that at the Board of Realtors, they would be appalled. But I say that in here, and I'm watching, and there's some heads bobbing, going, yeah, I can see that happening, you know? And so you understand me when nobody else does. You are my people. I love each and every one of you. I'm a card-carrying member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Even if you're a little too stiff for me, if you call me at 2 in the morning and ask for help, I would absolutely be there. And I think even if I'm too happy for you, if I called you at 2 in the morning and said, man, I'm thinking about drinking, I believe you would be there. Thanks.
Thank you. One more.
We celebrate birthdays at this meeting. We define sobriety as freedom from alcohol, pills, pot, anything that affects you from the neck up or makes you throw up in your pants. If your regular attender of this meeting would like to take a cake, please email our scribe, Ann P., at birthdays@pacificgroupla.org.
Hi, everybody. My name's Ann. I'm an alcoholic.
And please do this by 6:30. Otherwise, you have to wait until the following week to get recognized. We have several birthdays tonight, but tonight we've asked a special guest to come out and sing us happy birthday.
Hey, everybody. It's Xander Alcoholic. Ready? Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, happy birthday. Happy birthday to you. Keep coming back.
Woohoo! All right, let's see if we do this right this week. Hey, watch this. All right. Our birthdays tonight are, can you go back one screen, please? There we go. Artie A for 3 years, and her sponsor is the lovely Julie W. We have Michelle F for 10 years, and her sponsor is Baron G. We have Ned A for 24 years. His sponsor is Lloyd S. We have Karen C for 32 years, and her sponsor is Sally P. We have Greg W for 33 years. His sponsor is Jerry H. And we have Jerry H for 39 years, and his sponsor is Bob Z. And we have Judy R. for 44 years, a former secretary, and her sponsor is Susie A. So we have a total of 7 birthdays for 185 years. The average is 26.4. Congratulations to all of our birthday people. We have a custom at the Pacific Group of donating $1 for each candle on your birthday cake at the end of the year. This candle money is our contributions to AA organizations worldwide. If you wish to participate in this custom, please email our treasurer, Betty H., at treasurer@pacificgroupla.org. Underneath special announcements,